Today is Friday, October 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, federal agents in the U.S. thwart an alleged plot and announced charges against 13 members of two militia groups.
The alleged conspirators are extremists who undertook a plot to kidnap a sitting governor.
Will there be another presidential debate? That's the question.
At this point, it's really a matter of gamesmanship.
Also ahead, fans around the world remember John Lennon, who would have turned 80 years old today. It's all on today's International Edition. The fate of the next two debates between President Donald Trump and Democrat Joe Biden are unclear. The next one is scheduled for October 15th, but the schedule may be upended by the president's coronavirus diagnosis as both campaigns now consider how and when the debates will take place. Joining us is Professor Robert Boatwright, chair of the Department of Political Science at Clark University. First, a quick look at Wednesday night's face-off between Mike Pence and Kamala Harris. Learning that this was actually the second most watched vice presidential debate with 57 million viewers. Why such interest for an event that's normally not considered significant? Was it because people are stuck at home in a pandemic, or could it be the ages of the two men at the top of the ticket? What do you think?
It's probably a combination of both. I think there is a little bit more interest in the debate because of the higher possibility that either of them could become president. But I think you're right. There's also nothing else for people to do, and the prospect that there will be other debates is lower than, you know, we might have thought just a few weeks ago. So I'm sure a lot of people were interested, but my understanding is that viewership declined as it went on. I think that as people tuned in, they realized vice presidential debates aren't that exciting.
Do you think that either candidate moved the needle in one direction or another?
No, it would have taken something pretty catastrophic for it to affect the election at all. I think if you ask people a week from now what they remember, they're going to remember the fly on Mike Pence's head. And I think the only other thing I can see coming out of it is that women may remember that Mike Pence talked over both of the other women on the stage. I think those are the only takeaways from it.
Moving ahead now, we've had one presidential debate. The debate commission, the last time we spoke, had been talking about changing some of the rules so that it was a more civil discourse. And then, of course, since then, we've heard that the president contracted the coronavirus. They were talking about doing it virtually next week. The president said that he wouldn't do it if it was virtual. So it looks like both sides now are agreeing to potentially move it up a week. Is that something that has been done, can be done, and has been agreed to by the debate commission?
The debate commission has no legal standing whatsoever, right? It is a body completely separate from the government that responds to super detailed contracts and negotiations among the candidates. So technically, they don't have the latitude to change anything. They didn't have the latitude to make this next debate virtual. They don't have the latitude to do some of the things that were talked about after that first debate, you know, mute whoever's not speaking. They're supposed to abide by the agreements among the candidates. With that said, they're also powerless because they can't compel anybody to become involved at all. So at this point, it's really a matter of gamesmanship. Trump understands that a lot of people will watch him if he's on and won't if he's not. So you may recall in 2016, he skipped one of the primary debates just to show that he really wanted to have the ability to dictate the terms. So in the past, he's done this sort of thing, but he doesn't have any particular right to do that or not to do that. All the candidates can really do is threaten not to be involved. As to moving it, sure, the debate commission will go along if the candidates agree, but at this point, Trump needs the debates more than Biden does. I think Biden could easily not debate again, and as long as it didn't look like he was avoiding a debate, I don't think it would harm him at all. So ultimately, he's got sort of the upper hand in any sort of negotiations.
Could it potentially change anything at this point in the game?
In general, debates don't change things a whole lot. So I don't think it really changes things. States are already voting. People are already locked in. What we don't know and what we never will know is the polls moved last week. Biden appears to have opened up a slightly larger lead. Maybe that had to do with the first debate, but also maybe it has to do with the tax returns. Maybe it has to do with Trump getting COVID. We're never going to know because all of those three things were so closely packed together that you can't disentangle their effect on the rolling poll average. But in the past, we've got no indication that any debate has ever had a lasting effect on the general election. They have these passing effects where people change their minds for a couple days and then go back to the way they were.
Professor Robert Boatwright, chair of the Department of Political Science at Clark University, thanks for being with us. America's allies in Europe are watching closely as the U.S. presidential election enters its final leg. Transatlantic relations have at times been strained under President Trump, and some key European allies hope for a return to more stability under a Joe Biden presidency. But some other NATO members have welcomed Donald Trump's demands for Europe to pull its weight. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Shortly after his 2016 election victory, President Donald Trump declared that NATO was obsolete because, in his words, it wasn't taking care of terror. That alarmed NATO allies, shaken by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But by 2017, Trump's tone had changed.
Now they do fight terrorism. I said it was obsolete. It's no longer obsolete.
For Europe, the unpredictability has been difficult, says security analyst Julie Norman.
You want an ally who's going to be reliable, and especially an ally like the United States that traditionally has been, you know, such a heavyweight.
So what do NATO allies make of Trump's rival, Joe Biden?
Biden, from his past record, is much more favourable to NATO, and NATO remains the bedrock of British security as well as European security more generally.
Supporters of Donald Trump say he should be judged on his actions. The president oversaw the deployment of US troops and hardware to Poland in 2017 as part of NATO's biggest deployment since the Cold War. He remains a popular figure in Poland and other former Soviet states.
For some of those states, there would still probably be a preference for Trump to stay in the White House.
But in Germany's case, a major European ally, Trump has accused Berlin of being delinquent in its NATO payments and plans to withdraw 20,000 troops stationed in the country. While his tone is abrasive, the president tells truths that Europe doesn't want to hear, argues political commentator Matthew Paris.
He has, in an instinctive way, but been right about quite a few things that perhaps there was a need for to push back against China on trade issues. He's right about NATO spending. He's right about many European countries not pulling their weight.
Washington's tough stance on China may not change whoever wins the White House, says analyst Julie Norman.
Many Democrats, Biden included, share some of the concerns that Trump had around China and that many Europeans have around China as well.
The biggest transatlantic divergence during the Trump administration has been on climate change, with many in Europe seeing Biden as more sympathetic to their viewpoint, says analyst Leslie Vinjamuri.
I think it's very clear to Europe that, you know, the stakes could not be higher in this elections for what is arguably the most important issue at the international level over the next 10 years.
From Russia to conflicts in Libya and the Middle East to tensions with Turkey, Europe faces numerous strategic challenges. The US will likely play a key role, no matter who wins the presidential election in November. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In a further blow to the travel industry, Australia is warning its international borders are likely to stay closed because of COVID-19 restrictions until late next year. Foreign nationals were banned in March to help curb the spread of the coronavirus, and Australian citizens must get official permission to leave the country. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Last year, about 9 million overseas travellers arrived in Australia. The largest groups came from China, New Zealand and the United States. The pandemic has seen those numbers collapse. COVID-19 has turned Australia into a fortress. Its borders were closed to foreign nationals in March, helping to contain the disease but inflicting enormous economic harm. Australia is in a recession for the first time in three decades. The exclusion of overseas tourists and students intending to study in Australia has cost Australia billions of dollars in lost revenue. Australian citizens and permanent residents are allowed to fly home, but they must pay for mandatory hotel quarantine on their return. Tens of thousands of people are stranded in other countries because of strict quotas on those allowed into the quarantine system. Australians need official permission from the government to leave the country. Many of Australia's internal borders also have been closed to curb the spread of the virus. Most states and territories have managed to contain the virus, but reopening the country will take time, according to the Australian Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
Domestic borders are assumed to reopen around the end of this year. International travel, including by tourists and international students, is assumed to remain largely closed off until late next year and then gradually return over time. And a vaccine to be available around the end of 2021 is one of the assumptions in the budget.
Large-scale immigration, which has fueled prosperity in Australia, will only resume when international borders are reopened. By many global comparisons, Australia has mostly handled the pandemic well. It's recorded just over 27,000 coronavirus cases, and about 900 people have died. Geography has been a key part in its pandemic strategy. Australia is a huge island, and restricting international travel has helped to limit the spread of COVID-19. Safely reconnecting with the rest of the world promises to be a monumental challenge for the authorities here, though. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A day after President Donald Trump tweeted that all U.S. forces in the South Asian nation should return home before the end of the year, there's confusion over the announcement, which seems to have blindsided top military officials. Joining us now is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what are you hearing from your sources about all of this?
Well, the tweet exactly read that the United States, quote, should have the small remaining number of brave men and women serving in Afghanistan home by Christmas. And I immediately started contacting my sources, and all of them referred me to the White House. And so I continued that today. We were hoping that maybe Defense Secretary Mark Esper would take questions. He took no questions during his public event. The Pentagon continued to refer reporters like myself to the White House. And finally, I did hear from one military official who only spoke to me on the condition of anonymity. And he said that the president's tweet was the first word he'd seen about withdrawing before year's end. This also, in addition to within the Pentagon, it sent military experts on a tizzy. They could not contain their disdain for this. In some instances, the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's Brad Bowman was questioning why would the U.S. withdraw 2,000-4,000 forces from a place where there are more terrorist groups concentrated than any other location. The U.S. Government has said in the Afghanistan-Pakistan area, there are at least 20 U.S.-identified terrorist organizations there. Bradley Bowman called this just frankly bad policy, poorly coordinated, poorly implemented, and he said that it was completely done for political purposes before the election. And I think that is the worry of many of our allies. Many of our allies want to make sure that everything is done conditions-based on the ground. The NATO Secretary General reaffirmed that today, that the United States, NATO, went into Afghanistan together. They will make decisions on future adjustments together, and when the time is right, he said, they will leave together.
Could this also in some way hamper efforts for a peace deal between the Taliban and the Afghan government?
That is a concern from experts that I've spoken to today. Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution said, frankly, the United States cannot pull out of Afghanistan right now because it would condemn the country to a much more intense civil war. It would allow the Taliban to make some more gains, if not outright win the war that they're still fighting with the U.S.-supported Afghan government. And he said that more of the country would be at risk of turbulence, instability, and therefore being a viable place for Al-Qaeda or Islamic State or others to put sanctuary down and plan for future attacks. And we have to remember, that's why the United States and that's why international allies went into Afghanistan in the first place. It was not to make Afghanistan a perfect democracy. It was to keep terror groups from attacking the United States like they did on September 11th, 2001. And by and large, whether you agree with this war, or whether you disagree with this war and the way that it's been managed, that has remained true to the United States. There has not been another 9/11. So military commanders will look at this and say, look, they are doing their jobs. Those who are for staying in Afghanistan while the conditions are not met say that if you can continue to prevent a terrorist attack with just a few thousand troops, why would you pull them out and risk losing all the gains you've made for nearly two decades?
Hmm. Well, it sounds like the Taliban was pleased by the announcement from President Trump.
Yes, the Taliban said that they welcomed the remarks, that they considered the tweet a positive step for the agreement between the Taliban and the United States. So definitely thinking positive there.
Carla, in addition to a campaign promise, has the president or any of his allies expressed any reasoning behind this?
This has been a campaign promise that President Trump made, and he is trying to fulfill that promise. That is what he has said all along on the campaign trail. He has called the U.S. conflicts that they've been involved in abroad reckless, endless, ridiculous, and so he's trying to get out. His supporters have pointed towards the fight or the potential fight, the preparation for a conflict, if you will, with China and Russia, the near-peer competitors of the United States, and saying by removing troops from the Middle East, there can be a focus on that fight. However, the critics have pointed out, and let me say that I've spoken to some people who are very pro refocusing towards China because they feel like China is the long-term threat. But they caution that there is still a fight for influence within the Middle East with China and with Russia, and that also a few thousand troops will not make a difference on that type of fight. The United States had more than 100,000 troops in Iraq at one point, more than 100,000 troops in Afghanistan at one point. And now if you look at the presence of the United States, if you look at Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan combined, there's fewer than 8,000 troops there. So when you look at those numbers, you see that's not a huge commitment to a fight against potential terrorists. And in the opinion of several experts, it's reaping great benefits by being there.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, thanks so much. 13 people are accused in a plot to attack the Michigan Capitol building in Lansing and kidnap the governor of Michigan at her vacation home. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer calls those arrested
sick and depraved men.
U.S. Attorney Matthew Schneider says the men are violent extremists and view Whitmer as having uncontrolled power in restricting activity because of the coronavirus.
All of us in Michigan can disagree about politics, but those disagreements should never, ever amount to violence.
Whitmer says she understands the frustration during the pandemic.
You don't have to agree with me, but I do ask one thing. Never forget that we are all in this together. Let's show a little kindness and a lot more empathy.
Authorities say some of the men in Michigan said they belonged to or were associated with Wolverine Watchmen, which the government describes as a militia group. I'm Ed Donahue.
As the U.S., France, and Russia push for a ceasefire, intense fighting continues between Azerbaijan and Armenian forces, with each side blaming the other. The last few weeks of escalation in the decades-long conflict over the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh has claimed hundreds of lives and left streets in ruins. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Goris, Armenia, civilians are scrambling for shelter, and the human cost is clear.
After a bomb blast about 4 days ago, 83-year-old Angela Hovakiman and her two daughters fled their homes in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, where forces from Armenia and Azerbaijan have been fighting for nearly 2 weeks. She says two people died in the blast and much of the house was destroyed. Officials in Armenia say recent battles have been the most intense since the intermittent conflict began over the disputed region about 30 years ago. Artsdran Hovhannisyan, a spokesperson for the Armenian Ministry of Defense, says several cities and settlements in the disputed areas have been bombed and that so far neither side has gained or lost significant amounts of territory. Azerbaijan says Nagorno-Karabakh is part of its internationally recognized borders and it has recently taken over several villages and settlements in areas it says were illegally occupied. Armenia says the disputed area is an independent region under the protection of Armenia. Civilians on both sides are fleeing the battles, and dozens have been killed, including at least four children. A network of volunteers have mobilized here in Armenia, supplying food, clothes, and medicine to displaced families and temporary shelters. Jasmine Khachatryan coordinates a temporary shelter in a kindergarten about 90 kilometers outside the battle zone. She says people continue to arrive daily, traumatized and terrified. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Goris, Armenia.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute. VOA.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The U.S. West Coast has seen another unprecedented fire season this year, with dozens killed and millions of acres burned. Part of the solution to prevent future large fires may be found in lessons from Native American tribes who, for millennia, have used fire as a tool to keep ecosystems in balance. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Rick O'Rourke of the Yurok Tribe's Cultural Fire Management Council. The council trains firefighters from around the world in how to use fire to actually promote healthy forests.
Rick O'Rourke is a member of the Yurok tribe, whose homeland is in the northern part of what is now called the U.S. state of California. For about 40 years, O'Rourke has been an indigenous fire practitioner. That means he uses fire to fight fire, with knowledge passed down from his ancestors. As much of the U.S. West Coast, including Northern California, goes up in flames, many are looking to indigenous fire practitioners like O'Rourke for lessons in how to keep future fires in check. Here's O'Rourke.
We as the Yurok people have been using fire as a land management tool since the beginning of time. It's one of our first agreements with our creator to take care of our land. And he brought us fire and showed us how to use it to keep our lands open and clear for food securities and clean water and protection, actually, because of the grizzly bears used to be around here. And just to keep our balance.
But now things are out of balance. Today, much of Northern California is covered in thick pine forests. O'Rourke says that's not how it's supposed to be. Before white settlers arrived, he says the area was covered in forest savanna. The Yurok and other indigenous people used small burns to remove the undergrowth in forests. That practice helped maintain healthy grasslands dotted with fewer, larger trees. There was never enough fuel piled up for the big trees to go up in flames.
Say 200 years ago, 300 years ago, there was probably 30 to 50 trees per acre, and they were big trees, solid, well-established trees with small shrubs and undergrowth, and then as well as the leaf litter and, everything that falls out of trees in the course of a year. And as we bring fire down through there, we take all that rotting vegetation off of there.
But after white settlers colonized the area, things changed. The settlers removed indigenous people from most of their lands, and the new arrivals viewed fire with fear. For much of the last century, forest management's policy in the United States has suppressed all fires. That policy helped thick pine forests take over in Northern California. Those forests, piled high with dead logs, branches, and leaves, are a tinderbox. And as global warming leads to lower snowpack, less rainfall, and higher temperatures, the West Coast has seen the biggest fires in its history.
In some cases, it's not really bad management or mismanagement. It's no management. And to allow the forest to deposit that much fuel is just setting us up for failure. These fires are going to come through, and they're just going to moonscape everywhere they go.
This year, over 4 million acres have burned in California alone, killing 31 people and damaging or destroying over 9,000 structures. Scientists agree that unless global warming is brought under control, massive destructive fires are likely to continue in the western U.S. O'Rourke adds that a holistic approach to forest fires should also include a return to the old ways, using small fires year-round to mitigate big ones in the summer dry season.
If we apply fire in a different context, not in the middle of the summer, in the whole span of like fall through mid-spring, you know, we can put down fire and hold it, and it's beneficial fire, and it's not going to be these huge conflagrations of, you know, disastrous fires.
O'Rourke says Yurok forests have been spared the worst of this year's fires, but that doesn't mean they're safe forever.
You know, in a spiritual context, you know, everything out here is a being to us. It's a fellow being. And to look at the state that it's in, it's really sad. If we don't all get involved, this is just going to keep happening over and over and over. And we're going to lose lives, and we're going to lose our forests. And our whole ecosystem will just die.
O'Rourke says the recent fires have caused so much destruction that some people may fear all fires, even beneficial ones.
The hardest thing we're going to have to do is we're going to have to remove the stigma of the freight train of a fire running at you, because people are scared. They're going to have post-traumatic stress for years. And changing that understanding of fire as a monster versus fire as a tool. Fire, it's a keystone element. It has a right to exist.
That begins, O'Rourke says, by showing that fire can be used to promote life rather than take life. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
American poet Louise Gluck has won the 2020 Nobel Prize in Literature for her works exploring family and childhood in what the Swedish Academy described Thursday is an unmistakable voice that, with austere beauty, makes individual existence universal. Musicians from around the world are paying tribute today on what would have been the late Beatle legend John Lennon's 80th birthday. The rock and roll star who rose to fame in the early 1960s with bandmates Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr was born in Liverpool, England on October 9, 1940. Lennon was shot dead by a disturbed fan in New York on December 8, 1980, at the age of 40. The album Imagine, probably Lennon's most popular, was released in 1971. Its title track has been adopted by peace activists around the world as an unofficial anthem. Every year, fans from across the globe gather to commemorate Lennon's birthday and his death, singing songs from the Beatles and joining together to reflect on the impact his music had and continues to have on millions of people's lives. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening, and have a great weekend.